You're listening to a special edition of NPR on Health. I'm Joe Neal. Over the summer, we've been looking at the healthcare systems of five European nations to see how they're able to provide healthcare for all the residents. We've looked at Germany, France, the Netherlands. Today, we're going to look at Great Britain. NPR's Joanne Silberner traveled there recently and filed three reports that you're going to hear today. First, let me give you some background on the British system. In Britain, people never see a medical bill. All of the care is paid for by the government. The amount that's spent on health care per person in the UK is about half what is spent in the US. One way the British are able to keep costs so low is that they ration care, especially when it comes to expensive drugs like those for cancer. In our first report, Joanne looks at how the government decides not to pay in cases like lung cancer, where an expensive drug can offer the hope of a couple of more months to live.
In his spotlessly clean home in Cardiff, Wales, Donald Sutherland is in the midst of constructing an elaborate model railroad, complete with Scottish village. A tiny seven-car train races past.
That one is a model of one that I actually helped to restore.
He jokes he'll be finished in 25 years. Such a long-term project wasn't in his plans 13 years ago. At age 41, insurance broker Donald Sutherland was diagnosed with a particularly nasty form of lung cancer. A Scotsman of few words, he raises his red eyebrows as he tries to describe it.
It's a real gobsmacking experience when you get told it. That you've got malignant lung cancer. And when it was diagnosed, they gave me 3 months to live.
3 months seemed hopeless. Sutherland got his affairs in order. One thing he didn't worry about was paying for his treatment. It was financed by tax revenues. He paid no bills. He started right away at the Comprehensive Cancer Center near his home.
I had two full courses of chemotherapy. I had 3 courses of radiotherapy in my chest and on my head because I had the brain tumour removed, which was a secondary tumour from the lung cancer.
For reasons not even his oncologist can explain, Sutherland is still alive 13 years later. If Sutherland's lung cancer goes on the attack again, there's a new, very expensive drug available, Tarceva. Now, this drug won't cure the type of cancer Sutherland has, but it can extend life, according to one study, by an average of a couple of months. If he wanted Tarceva, he'd have to pay the several thousand dollars a month cost himself. The National Health Service won't pay for it because it hasn't proven to be effective enough for his type of lung cancer. In the U.S., people can get it with the help of insurance or charity, but some people have gone broke. The cost of the drug just isn't worth it to Sutherland.
If I was going to die in the near future, and in the meantime I was going to bankrupt my wife, you know, because we'd need to get money together for treatment, I wouldn't have the treatment.
Not even if you thought it might extend your life a month or 2 months or 3 months.
Is that any great thing?
This is where the medical cultures of the U.S. and the U.K. split. In the U.S., there's a strong tendency for doctors and patients to pursue even the smallest hope. But Brits like Sutherland and his oncologist, Fergus Macbeth, see it differently. Macbeth says he doesn't think Tarceva offers much hope to people with lung cancer like Sutherland's.
From the evidence that I've seen, it is effective for a few patients, but not for many. And the average benefit in terms of the improvement in mean survival is a matter of a few months. And it has got significant toxicity, not as bad as some chemotherapy, but it does have not trivial toxicity for some patients.
That toxicity includes diarrhea, vomiting and rashes, and the risk of serious liver and lung problems. He has other things to offer his patients, other drugs, the knowledge that cancer is unpredictable, and simple, good doctoring.
I think there is a huge role that we have, which is beyond just giving them the treatment. It's about managing their pain, managing their symptoms, managing them psychologically as best we can, and managing their family as well.
Macbeth doesn't want to inflate his patients' hopes, something he sees happening in the US.
What to me seems to be a culture of gross overtreatment of patients, of raising false hopes and putting patients through extreme treatments for very modest gains or very modest probability of gains.
The man in charge of saying yes or no is Sir Michael Rollins. He heads a government agency, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. The agency decides for the NHS whether new and expensive drugs are worth the cost. Rollins knows his agency can disappoint.
People who've got a lethal illness and want a drug that they think will cure it, want it now.
But denying the chance of a few extra weeks or months, I asked him, isn't that taking hope away?
Yes, I mean, in some ways that's true. And for people with life-threatening diseases, hope it can be very important. And as a physician myself, I know that and I understand it. But the truth of the matter is, we just can't do it any longer.
Can't do it any longer because paying huge amounts of money for every new drug with the faintest hope of extending life even a little would make it impossible for the NHS to provide universal care. And Rollins is sure that someday Americans will have to deal more directly with these same thorny questions of rationing and the high price of hope.
You will one day have to take cost effectiveness into account. There is no doubt about it at all. You cannot keep on increasing your healthcare costs at the rate you are for so poor return. You are 29th in the world in life expectancy. You pay almost twice as much on healthcare per person as anyone else in God's earth.
And there are millions of Americans with no access to routine health care. This is the trade-off that the UK has made, rationing care so that everyone is covered.
And we have in Britain, as in most of Europe, actually, had a healthcare system that, based on the principle of social solidarity, that we look after each other in time when we're sick. And that's very precious, actually, to us. And I think that's what we find so difficult to understand about your healthcare system. You don't have that.
Cancer patient Donald Sutherland is satisfied with the British system, even with its limits.
I think we're quite patient people, albeit that, you know, if we want something, you know, we'll make sure that we get it. And I think, by and large, that in my experience, I can only say that whenever I've needed National Health Service, it's always been there, and I've always had first-class treatment.
He says he doesn't expect his fellow taxpayers to pay for a drug unless there's solid proof that there's a benefit.
You have to be realistic about this. You know, the demands are infinite, but, you know, the resources are finite. And you just have to accept it.
A concept that Americans have resisted. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Now, earlier you may remember that I said that spending on health care per person in the UK is about half what it is in the U.S. The numbers, and they're kind of hard to come up with, but the best numbers that we could find are that $2,700 is spent on health care per person in the U.K. each year, and that compares to about $6,400 in the U.S. Those numbers come from 2006, and of course, both countries have seen those numbers go up. If you want to learn more and compare the systems of all five countries that we've looked at, you can go to our website, npr.org/health. Next, Joanne looks at something that's also very expensive in both countries, and that's chronic care. People who have diseases over the course of their lifetime spend more than people who are healthy. In this story, she looks at two patients with multiple sclerosis.
In the storybook English village of Buckland, 55-year-old Linda Oatley spends her days renovating her new cottage. This morning, she's at a health center 10 minutes from her house, getting ready for something she considers torture, physical therapy.
Would you mind, Karen? Thank you very much. Yes, put a mat down for me. I'll take my shoes off.
Oatley's got smart black glasses and blonde-streaked hair. She was a sales executive, but now she gets fatigued easily and can't work. Her therapy takes place in a mirror-lined room filled with cheerful blue workout mats, giant red and orange exercise balls, and stacks of weight racks. Lined up against the wall, wheelchairs and canes. Oatley was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1999. She has a pronounced limp. Exercises to regain and maintain control of her leg hurt. Oatley's lying on her back. She's got an exercise ball under her knees.
Oh, that's hard for me to do. I mean, that stretches me because this is where my problem is, in the hip.
Workouts usually last an hour. Outside, over a cup of tea, she tells us what happened nearly 10 years ago.
I felt this odd sensation in my both legs, actually. This is weird, but it felt warm on the inside. And when I would take a bath or the shower, the hot water felt cold and cold water felt hot.
She wasn't at all sure the National Health Service, the NHS, could help her. It's always gotten bad press in England. And earlier this month, a study by doctors and MS advocates found that about a half of Brits with MS had to wait 4.5 months for an initial visit with a specialist. Well, they gave the NHS a try. She ended up seeing a specialist within weeks.
He recommended that very day an MRI scan, a pulmonary function test, an X-ray, and a blood test. And so all that was done that afternoon, and I went back the very next week for the results.
Accepting the diagnosis was hard.
For 6 months, I was beside myself. In fact, they'll tell you, when I first came here, I was like a little mouse. I couldn't talk to anybody. I saw all these very sick people. I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be like that. I'm going to be in a chair. I'm not going to be able to walk or talk or swallow. What am I going to do? I'm going to die. And I didn't die, and the moment passed.
At the time, there were several new MS drugs thought to slow or stop the disease. In the U.S., they were already available, but they cost thousands of dollars per month. In the U.K., the National Health Service wouldn't pay for them for Oatley's type of MS. There wasn't enough proof that they worked. Oatley paid out of pocket until the NHS was satisfied the drug might help people like her.
And then I started to get it free. They would deliver it every month, and they gave me my money back. So they reimbursed me the £5,000 I'd spent. How cool is that? I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Medically, she's happy with what she's getting now. She sees a neurologist twice a year, and when she has flare-ups, she can see that specialist without a wait. Oatley's one gripe is that she has to pay $30 a week out of pocket for her ongoing rehab sessions. But she's certain the physical therapy and friendships are helping her cope with her MS.
What I don't get on the NHS, of course, is the physiotherapy and the fun of coming here every week. It is fun.
I ask Oatley how she would have felt if she had had to pay cash for all her own medical care.
I wouldn't know where to start. I mean, I think it would be just so mentally debilitating. I think I'd have topped myself. That's a euphemism for killing yourself.
I tell her, sometimes people in the US have to pay their own way.
So what do they do? What do they do? You've asked them, what do they do?
Amy, you want to read a book with Daddy?
In Philadelphia, MS patient Jeffrey Rubin sits all day in a rented house. He can't work now, but he takes care of his 4-year-old daughter, Taryn.
What is this?
Sky.
Is it daylight or nighttime?
Nighttime.
He's a big bear of a guy. Taryn is tiny. She nestles in his arms.
What are all these?
The sun is going to come up soon.
Yeah, see, back there. Yeah, right. It's going to come up soon.
There are no trips to the park with Taryn, even with a cane. Reuben can walk only about half a block. His disease is more aggressive than Oatley's. Reuben shows me his medications. It's an effort for him. They're on a high shelf in the kitchen, out of reach of his 4 kids. There's a twice-a-day pill for his back, $200-some-odd a month, an antidepressant, a drug that prevents muscle spasms, several painkillers, a drug to stay awake during the day.
This one is 200 milligrams 3 times a day. This was over $1,000 for this thing.
When he was in his late 30s, Reuben had a comfortable life. He supervised quality control at a medical packaging company. He had health insurance. His wife was a homemaker. They'd bought a house a few blocks from where he went to high school.
Memorial Day weekend of 2006, I was working midnight shift, and all of a sudden, without warning, without anything, I saw basically a black circle right in the middle of my eyes. I went numb the entire left side of my body. Then I had excruciating pain shoot right up, like more towards the right side of my back.
He was taken to the hospital. He had multiple sclerosis. He eventually lost his job, and he couldn't pay for his health insurance on his own.
I don't have the money. I mean, I'm already paying, of course, my mortgage and everything else, all the utilities. What am I going to do? I don't know what to do now. I mean, everything just came closing down.
He begged money from his parents, borrowed from friends. Strangers dropped off food. He got drug samples from his doctors, but not enough.
If I don't take all my medications, who knows what's going to happen, or I'm spreading out the medications as much as I can. Instead of taking one pill a day, I'm cutting it in half and taking half a pill a day.
Reuben got state medical assistance, Medicaid. When he went to fill his prescriptions, the pharmacy said he wasn't covered. None of his doctors belonged to the program. To pay his medical bills, he stopped paying his mortgage.
They took the house, so that was the end of that. The house was nice. I liked my house.
Then he declared bankruptcy. Finally, Reuben qualified for government disability payments.
And then I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have health insurance now. No. Now we come to the two-year waiting period because you get Medicare, but you have to wait 2 years for Medicare. So since I got it in December of 06, I have to wait till December of 08 in order to qualify for health insurance through Medicare.
Reuben is one of more than 250,000 disabled people with no insurance at all who are stuck waiting to qualify for Medicare, according to the Commonwealth Fund. Recently, his wife got a job at his kid's charter school. Now they have health insurance, but with some big co-payments for Jeff's care. So the scorecard comes to this. For Linda Oatley in England, who started out thinking the NHS wouldn't do much for her, a bit of a delay in getting coverage for a drug, a small fee for physical therapy.
And in the end, if you do the right things, ask the right questions, go to the right places, or, you know, get help and advice, you can get the care that you need from the get-go.
And the scorecard for Jeff Reuben? A year and a half of cutting his medications, a repossessed house, and bankruptcy. A few years ago, he would not have supported a government-run system.
I may have had a different opinion, because, you know what, because then you're talking about taking away your freedom of choice, I guess. Why should I have someone tell me to do this and tell me to do that? Unless you fall into this type of situation, I guess you just don't understand it.
Reuben's two-year waiting period is up in December, and he'll get on Medicare then. If his condition doesn't get any worse, he hopes to start doing some motivational speaking. Joanne Solberner, NPR News.
After the series was broadcast on the radio, we got a lot of emails from listeners saying that they didn't think we made it clear enough that there's rationing in the U.S. too, just like there is in the U.K. The rationing in the U.S., of course, takes place before you ever get care when you can't get coverage in the first place, and there are 47 million Americans who lack health coverage. Now, this next story looks specifically at a situation in the U.K. where an expensive drug was denied to a patient, and he appealed that decision.
What's at stake in this fight is Jack Tagg's crystal blue right eye and his ability to enjoy his retirement and his lovely garden on a hill overlooking the southwest end of the English Channel.
We have cultivated blackberries, thornless blackberries. We have greengages. And, of course, the usual flowers, roses, begonias. We have a waterfall down here.
It's a gentle, sunny day. Jack Tagg, a former World War II pilot, is feeling pretty good for a man of 89.
Well, as well as a fellow approaching middle age can feel.
But back in January,
I discovered that my right eye was fading.
Jack Tagg worried. He loves to read and drive around and draw portraits off of photographs.
After a few days, I was seen by the specialist, and to my surprise, he told me that I had age-related macular degeneration.
That's a disease of the retina. It hits one eye at a time, and it can progress rapidly.
He gave me three choices. He says, we can either let nature take its course, in which case I should lose the middle sight in my right eye.
Or Jack Tagg could pay for the dozen or so injections of a drug called Lucentis. The cost? $15,000 or more.
Or they could apply for me to receive funding.
By funding, he means requesting that the National Health Service, or NHS, pay for it.
So naturally I said, apply for me to receive funding.
Like most people in England, Jack Tagg gets his care through a tax-funded system. Doctors are paid by the government. He doesn't see a bill, so long as a local government board approves the treatment. And most things are approved. But Tagg's ophthalmologist wanted to use Lucentis.
And they rejected me for treatment.
They turned him down. They'd only paid the high price of Lucentis after Jack Tagg had already lost sight in one eye. Because after all, he still had the other eye, at least until that eye got hit by the disease.
I would have gone blind, unless we could have sold the house and got some money.
The payment policy was set by a national board that considers both effectiveness and costs. TAG thought the board was relying too heavily on cost and not looking enough at benefit. I asked him, what limits should there be on care?
You tell me how much an eye is worth, and I'll answer your question.
Jack TAG decided to take action.
My friend the doctor had a brilliant idea to put a message on the doctor's website asking doctors to send £5 cheques to the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, to pay for my treatment.
TAG took us to see Martin Rankin, his friend, the doctor.
We're going out to meet my partner in crime. Hello.
They settled down in front of a medieval stone fireplace. Over coffee, Rankin said the board's decision just didn't make sense.
Preserving binocular vision is important for people to preserve their mobility, to be able to accurately perceive depth.
And it wasn't just Jack TAG he was worried about.
And that's important for everyone's safety because Jack still climbs behind the wheel of his car at the age of 88.
89.
I'm sorry, Jack.
So Jack TAG and Martin Rankin took the hundreds of checks they had collected to London, to the Prime Minister, at number 10 Downing Street.
So I thought, well, should I knock timidly on the door, or will I do the job properly? So I stepped up and grabbed the knocker and banged it as hard as I could. And there was a huge noise. The bang was just enormous, and it sort of echoed around Downing Street.
With reporters and news cameras all around, an official came out and took the checks. Jack TAG and Dr. Rankin got plenty of coverage. It's right there in the headlines pasted in the scrapbook TAG has brought with him.
Withholding vital treatment beggars belief.
Hero is told, you can't have drugs until you go blind.
War veteran sees red at NHS policy.
Checks of shame to be handed to the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister's office returned the checks with a polite note.
We were like celebrities for a couple of weeks, weren't we, Jack?
Yeah.
And Jack was getting mail sent to him, and it would be addressed to Jack, War Hero, Torquay.
The town of Torquay can now boast of being home to Agatha Christie, the British TV show Fawlty Towers, and Jack TAG. But being a war hero wasn't enough for the local health board. A spokesperson refused to make anyone available to NPR to explain their action. But in London, at the House of Commons, Adrian Sanders is happy to talk. He's a member of Parliament who represents Torquay. He remembers how TAG showed up at an open house he holds regularly in his home district.
Well, he came, he and his wife, just turned up and turned up unannounced, as people do, and people come along and will tell me their problems, and it can be anything, you name it.
Sanders says he doesn't get many complaints about the health service, so he took TAG's concerns to several national health officials. He suspects they pressured the local health board, the Care Trust. Not long after, the Care Trust offered to pay for Jack TAG's Lucentis.
The Care Trust was clearly embarrassed by the case.
TAG was going to turn down the offer unless it was extended to everyone in his situation.
Yeah, fighting for liberty, come on.
Dr. Rankin convinced him to take it and continue to fight. Jack TAG's story may seem like a failure of the British health system. An 89-year-old man had to take on the government to get the treatment he wanted. But Dr. Martin Rankin doesn't see it that way at all.
We see it as being a wrong that's been righted.
He says the ability to fight and win is proof the system works.
So it shows that we expect in this country, we expect everybody's needs to be met. And when it doesn't happen, we're both outraged and astonished. And we protest and it gets fixed.
And in fact, the decision-making body now says health boards shouldn't wait for the first eye to go blind. They should pay for Lucentis right away in cases where it's appropriate. Officials say it wasn't a result of TAG's activism, but a scheduled reconsideration of the data. As for Jack TAG, well, maybe the best way to see if the system worked for him is to climb into his little blue Renault for a ride through the green rolling hills around Torquay. He says after three treatments, he sees fine. But he asks his wife, Gay, for help navigating.
Look backwards.
I'm looking down.
can see him all right.
Stop.
It's just the wall I'm worried about.
The car is dwarfed by the ancient 8-foot-tall hedges that border the narrow lane. Tag was not only a pilot, he once ran a driving school. Still, his wife has only just started to feel comfortable driving with him since his treatment for blindness started.
I've got over my sight now. And he's only blind in one eye. Someone suggested...
Cyclops. I'm not blind in either eye.
They put a notice in the back, child on board. I wanted to put one saying blind driver wheel.
He drives fast and happily. And we arrive safely back at his house.
Like a sherry or whatever. Say when.
He sits back and looks at his garden, takes a bite of a lamb and butter sandwich, and savors his victory.
We more than achieved our aims, more than. We've got free treatment. And we've got a review in the fall. There's a review of the entire machinery of the NHS.
He says if socialized medicine is going to work, sometimes people have to stand up and fight. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
That's it for this podcast. Remember that you can find out more about the countries and their universal health systems by going to our website, npr.org/health. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.